So now we begin chapter 24, The Evolution of the Spiritual Man. This was one of the last six chapters which Sri Aurobindo specially composed to complete his magnum opus. He opens with a series of what he calls mottos, and the first is taken from the Gita, and it is a summary statement in some ways of the essence of the spiritual path. Let's read what he says as he translates it from the Sanskrit. Even as men come to me, so I accept them. It is my path, mama vartma, that men follow from all sides. Whatever form the worshiper chooses to worship with faith, I set in him firm faith in it. Achalam Shraddham. And with that faith, he puts his yearning into his adoration and gets his desire dispensed by me. But limited is that fruit. Those whose sacrifice is to the gods, to elemental spirits, Bhutani, reach the gods, reach the elemental spirits, but those whose sacrifice is to me they come. The me that he describes is the Supreme Divine, who is part and parcel of all that we see here. Yes, he is immanent in the universe. The whole universe is absorbed in his being. But he is also transcendent, and in his transcendence, he remains a person, not a mere impersonal vast into which the drop disappears as it merges into the ocean. Whatever method of your advance, the divine welcomes you. Whatever growth you seek, the divine is there, if you fulfill the conditions, to grant you the fruit of your effort. But if your effort is low, then low will be the fruit you attain. If, having seen through it all, having surveyed all that is available in the universe, you aspire beyond to reach that very source from which universe and self come, then that shall be your fruit. Choose. So that's the Gita, drawing from the fourth, the seventh, and the ninth chapters. Let's move on. The next is a citation from the Rig Veda. In these, there is not the wonder and the might, Chitram. The truths occult exist not for the mind of the ignorant. Ninyani achite abhuva. If you float on the superficies of existence, if you stay on the surfaces, you cannot see the secrets which lie at greater depths. So don't look to those who are possessed only of the exterior view for a view of what is profound about existence, about what is possible in life. The next is from the Rig Veda also. As a seer, kavi, working out the occult truths, ninyam, and their discoveries of knowledge, he brought into being the seven craftsmen, Saptakarun, of heaven. And in the light of day, they spoke and wrought the things of their wisdom. So one who sees can manifest, that is, make plain, make it come to the front, make it visible, can manifest the secret treasures by dint of a growing light, the light of day. The next is from the Rig Veda also, one of our favorite passages. Seer wisdoms, secret words that speak their meaning to the seer. Ditanyagne nivya vachamsi nivachana kavaye kavyani. The mystic alone can understand the secrets in these secret words. The mystic, in his inspiration, encodes in the cryptic messages of the Rig Veda, in the Rigs, those perceptions, those insights into what lie at the basis of the world. If you have yourself the insight developing in you, then when you see that utterance, when you hear that utterance, then you see that knowledge. It is attainable. It is patent to you. If you do not have that development, if you do not have that consciousness, then it is a hearsay knowledge, or it is altogether imperceptible. So the Veda is a body of knowledge to one who can see. If you have the insight, then you have the necessary means of entering into it. If you want the insight, you have to develop it before you approach the Veda. The next is also from the Veda. And by the way, all these are drawn from really old texts, not the newer mandalas in the Veda, the first and the tenth. These are from very old material indeed. None knows the birth of these. They know each other's way of begetting, but the wise Dhira perceives these hidden mysteries, Ninya again. Even that which the great goddess, the many-hued mother, bears as her teat of knowledge, Prishnir Yad Udho Mahi. Again, the one who has the vision can understand the manifold universe that comes out of the mother and is nourished by her. So you have the sense of a living, a growing universe. And in a sense, if you develop a consciousness that is sufficiently broad, sufficiently deep, you can participate in the manifestation, almost as a co-creator. Because the seer in the Veda is also creating the world with his sight. And to hear the Rigs is to listen to the worlds being chanted into being. The next citation is from the Mundaka Upanishad, the Upanishad of the Razor. Made certain of the meaning of the highest spiritual knowledge, purified in their being. This is interesting. The highest spiritual knowledge is his English translation of Vedanta Vijnana. This is one of the earliest uses or earliest instances of the term Vedanta. It occurs in this great Upanishad, which is one of the later Upanishads. Vedanta means literally the end of the Veda, as if the conclusion, the culmination. In some senses, one can take it that way. Vijnana is a superlative knowledge. It is a complete, a comprehensive knowledge. And you'll remember, of course, that Sri Aurobindo often translated the supramental into the Sanskrit as the term vijnana. Purified in their being, shuddha sattva. So their being has been made light, buoyant, settled in equipoise. The last is again from the Mundaka. He strives by these means and has the knowledge. In him, this spirit, Atma, enters into its supreme status, Brahma Dhamma. Satisfied in knowledge, having built up their spiritual being, the wise, Dhira, in union with the spiritual self, Yuktamanas, reach the omnipresent everywhere and enter into the all. Sarvam eva vishanti. So, one as an individual merges into Brahman, the transcendent, and then establishes oneself in the universal status. First you get the essential realization, and then you find oneness with all about. You move from innate, ineradicable status of knowledge into breadth of knowledge. So I think now we're ready to enter into it, now that we've seen how he is establishing our view of the Vedanta here. Clearly, the advancing spiritual consciousness of the human grows into an awareness of what the universe is really about. What is the purpose of the cosmos? Where does it come from? What is a person's place in it? What mission is given to the advancing human spirit? And so the title, The Evolution of the Spiritual Man. In the earliest stages of evolutionary nature, we are met by the dumb secrecy of her inconscience. There is no revelation of any significance or purpose in her works, no hint of any other principles of being than that first formulation, which is her immediate preoccupation, and seems to be forever her only business. For in her primal works, matter alone appears, the sole, dumb, and stark cosmic reality. A witness of creation. If there had been one conscious but uninstructed, would only have seen appearing out of a vast abyss of an apparent non-existence an energy busy with the creation of matter, a material world and material objects, organizing the infinity of the inconscient into the scheme of a boundless universe or a system of countless universes that stretched around him into space without any certain end or limit. a tireless creation of nebulae and star clusters and suns and planets, existing only for itself, without a sense in it, empty of cause or purpose. And you'll remember his early chapters as he's beginning to examine the essence of being, that he also describes a universe in which, if there were a witness watching, they would see this. So here at the end of the book, he's back. He's recalled that witness. It might have seemed to him a stupendous machinery without a use, a mighty, meaningless movement, an aeonic spectacle without a witness, a cosmic edifice without an inhabitant. For he would have seen no sign of an indwelling spirit, no being for whose delight it was made. A creation of this kind could only be the outcome of an inconscient energy or an illusion cinema, a shadow play or puppet play of forms reflected on a superconscient, indifferent absolute. Now, in a way, this is interesting because we see the play of nature arising out of an apparent inconscience, throwing itself out into clusters of galaxies, but still merely a material world, and this witness watching it, Purusha watching Prakriti. Let me reread. I think I've read this sentence. A creation of this kind could only be the outcome of an inconscient energy or an illusion cinema, a shadow play or puppet play of forms reflected on a superconscient, indifferent absolute. So there are a number of things in here. When he says an inconscient energy, well, we understand that to be the material universe. If he says an illusion cinema, well, here we're pulled into his own experience as he attained his first realization of Brahman Nirvana, in which the world became perceptible only as a cinematographic shape, void of substance, void of reality. So, Vedantic in its more near-term usage, that is, the universe is unreal, and there is a silent spirituality behind, which is that which is real. A shadow play or puppet play of forms reflected on a superconscient, indifferent absolute. So the world is either an inconscient energy or it's this shadowy play. That, the absolute, is real, but the world is unreal. He would have seen, this presumed witness, no evidence of a soul and no hint of mind or life in this immeasurable and interminable display of matter. So, in other words, this witness would regard either a physical world, or he would see that perhaps there is a reality beyond, but this world itself is a phantasmagoria and not real. In other words, the reality is absent in the world. A conscious reality, a spiritual reality, is absent from the world to this first witness. It would not have seemed to him possible or imaginable that there could at all be in this desert universe, forever inanimate and insensible, an outbreak of teeming life, a first vibration of something occult and incalculable, alive and conscious, a secret spiritual entity feeling its way towards the surface. so that the material universe could contain life and matter and an emerging spiritual consciousness would be impossible for that witness to imagine. But after some eons, looking out once more on that vain panorama, he might have detected in one small corner at least of the universe this phenomenon, a corner where matter had been prepared, its operations sufficiently fixed, organized, made stable, adapted as a scene of a new development, the phenomenon of a living matter, a life in things that had emerged and become visible. But still, the witness would have understood nothing, for evolutionary nature still veils her secret. He would have seen a nature concerned only with establishing this outburst of life, this new creation. But life living for itself, with no significance in it. A wanton and abundant creatrix, busy scattering the seed of her new power and establishing a multitude of its forms in a beautiful and luxurious profusion, or later, multiplying endlessly genus and species for the pure pleasure of creation. A small touch of lively color and movement would have been flung into the immense cosmic desert and nothing more. The witness could not have imagined that a thinking mind would appear in this minute island of life, that a consciousness could awaken the inconscient, a new and greater subtler vibration come to the surface and betray more clearly the existence of the submerged spirit. It would have seemed to him at first that life had somehow become aware of itself, and that was all. For this scanty newborn mind seemed to be only a servant of life, a contrivance to help life to live, a machinery for its maintenance, for attack and defense, for certain needs and vital satisfactions, for the liberation of life instinct and life impulse. It could not have seemed possible to him that in this little life, so inconspicuous amid the immensities, in one sole species out of this petty multitude, a mental being would emerge, a mind serving life still, but also making life and matter its servants, using them for the fulfillment of its own ideas, will, wishes. A mental being who would create all manner of utensils, tools, instruments out of matter for all kinds of utilities, erect out of it cities, houses, temples, theaters, laboratories, factories, chisel from it statues and carve cave cathedrals, invent architecture, sculpture, painting, poetry, and 100 crafts and arts, discover the mathematics and physics of the universe and the hidden secret of its structure, live for the sake of mind and its interests, for thought and knowledge, develop into the thinker, the philosopher, and scientist, and, as a supreme defiance to the reign of matter, awake in himself to the hidden Godhead, become the hunter after the invisible, the mystic, and the spiritual seeker. So this first witness of the developing universe would have been boggled by the appearance of all of this. But if after several ages or cycles, the witness had looked again and seen this miracle in full process, even then perhaps obscured by his original experience of the sole reality of matter in the universe, he would still not have understood. It would still seem impossible to him that the hidden spirit could wholly emerge, complete in its consciousness, and dwell upon the earth as the self-knower and world-knower, nature's ruler and possessor. Impossible, he might say. All that has happened is nothing much. A little bubbling of sensitive gray stuff of brain, a queer freak and a bit of inanimate matter moving about on a small dot in the universe. On the contrary, a new witness intervening at the end of the story, informed of the past developments, but unobsessed by the deception of the beginning, might cry out, "Ah, then, this was the intended miracle, the last of many. The spirit that was submerged in the inconscience has broken out from it and now inhabits, unveiled, the form of things which, veiled, it had created as its dwelling place and the scene of its emergence." That is an improved view. But in fact, a more conscious witness might have discovered the clue at an early period of the unfolding, even in each step of its process. For at each stage, nature's mute secrecy, though still there, diminishes. A hint is given of the next step. A more overtly significant preparation is visible. Already, in what seems to be inconscient in life, the signs of sensation coming towards the surface are visible. In moving and breathing life, the emergence of sensitive mind is apparent, and the preparation of thinking mind is not entirely hidden. While, in thinking mind, when it develops, there appear, at an early stage, the rudimentary strivings, and afterwards, the more developed seekings of a spiritual consciousness. As plant life contains in itself the obscure possibility of the conscious animal, as the animal mind is astir with the movements of feeling and perception, and the rudiments of conception that are the first ground for man the thinker, so, man, the mental being, is sublimated by the endeavor of the evolutionary energy to develop out of him the spiritual man, the fully conscious being, man exceeding his first material self and discoverer of his true self and highest nature. But if this is to be accepted as the intention in nature, there are two questions that put themselves at once and call for a definitive answer. First, the exact nature of the transition from mental to spiritual being, and when that is given, the process and method of the evolution of the spiritual out of the mental man. It would at first sight seem evident that as each gradation emerges not only out of its precedent grade but in it, as life emerges in matter and is largely limited and determined in its self-expression by its material conditions, as mind emerges in life and matter and is similarly limited and determined in its self-expression by life conditions and material conditions, so spirit too must emerge in a mind embodied in life and matter and must be largely limited and determined by the mental conditions in which it has its roots, as well as the life conditions, the material conditions of its existence here. It might even be maintained that if there has been any evolution of the spiritual in us, It is only as a part of the mental evolution. A special operation of man's mentality. The spiritual element is not a distinct or separate entity and cannot have an independent emergence or a supramental future. The mental being can develop a spiritual interest or preoccupation and may evolve, perhaps in consequence, a spiritual as well as an intellectual mentality, a fine soul flower of his mental life. The spiritual may become a predominant trend in some men, just as in others there is a predominant artistic or pragmatic trend. But there can be no such thing as a spiritual being taking up and transforming the mental into the spiritual nature. There is no evolution of the spiritual man. There is only an evolution of a new and possibly a finer and rarer element in a mental being. This is an argument still expressed in the field of evolutionary philosophy, or should I say the philosophy of evolution. No real agreement across the board that it is possible for a new rung of consciousness to emerge, separate from mind. In fact, there is often in current thinking a merging of all of this so that mind becomes indistinguishable from life and from matter all being a common entity. And that even the distinction of life from matter or of mind from life is intentionally erased by some evolutionary thinkers. But again, this whole essay so far is a depiction in philosophic terms of what he has found in these citations from the Rig Veda, that if you don't have the vision, you can't see what is deeply there. Your eye is limited to the surface of things. And so your interpretations of the world are superficial. If you cannot perceive deeply enough, then you don't see that there is a spiritual substance at the basis of all this. At the very roots of matter, as it lies in its trance, as it stirs in life, as it awakens in mind, and as it must continue to progress into a spiritual consciousness. He'll make the argument clear. This, then, is what has to be brought out. The clear distinction between the spiritual and the mental. The nature of this evolution and the factors which make it possible and inevitable that there should be this emergence of the spirit in its true distinct character, not remaining as it now for the most part is in its process or seems to be in its way of appearance, a subordinate or a dominating feature of our mentality, but defining itself as a new power which will finally overtop the mental part and replace it as the leader of the life and nature. And here, of course, he means by spirit the supramental consciousness, that there will be an evolution in which the human vaults beyond the wall of the separating mind and arrives in the unitary vision of a consciousness which sees comprehensively, which affects what it sees, and which is one with all that it sees. And that takes us back to those Vedantic expressions with which we began the chapter. It is quite true that to a surface view, life seems only an operation of matter. Mind an activity of life. But it might seem to follow that what we call the soul or spirit is only a power of mentality. Soul, a fine form of mind. Spirituality, a high activity of the embodied mental being. But this is a superficial view of things, due to the thoughts concentrating on the appearance and process, and not looking at what lies behind the process. One might as well, on the same lines, have concluded that electricity is only a product or operation of water and cloud matter, because it is in such a field that lightning emerges. But a deeper inquiry has shown that both cloud and water have, on the contrary, the energy of electricity as their foundation, their constituent power or energy substance. That which seems to be a result is, in its reality, though not in its form, the origin. The effect is in the essence pre-existent to the apparent cause, the principle of the emergent activity precedent to its present field of action. This is a primary dictum of Vedantic philosophy, that the result already inheres in the cause. So it is throughout evolutionary nature. Matter could not have become animate if the principle of life had not been there constituting matter and emerging as a phenomenon of life in matter. Life in matter could not have begun to feel, perceive, think, reason if the principle of mind had not been there behind life and substance, constituting it as its field of operation and emergent in the phenomenon of a thinking life and body. So too, spirituality emerging in mind is the sign of a power which itself has founded and constituted life, mind, and body, and is now emerging as a spiritual being in the living and thinking body. How far this emergence will go, whether it will become dominant and transform its instrument, is a subsequent question. But what is necessary first to posit is the existence of spirit as something else than mind and greater than mind, spirituality as something other than mentality, and the spiritual being therefore as something distinct from the mental being. Spirit is a final evolutionary emergence because it is the original involutionary element and factor. Evolution is an inverse action of the involution. What is an ultimate and last derivation in the involution is the first to appear in the evolution. What was original and primal in the involution is in the evolution, the last and supreme emergence. So, as infinite being and consciousness and delight, Satchit-Ananda, involved itself into denser and denser formations of its own being, taking the infinity of its light and refracting it into mind, taking the enormity of its power and reducing it to prana, taking the substance of its absolute being and densifying it into matter. These things emerge in reverse order. That which served as the linking bridge between the higher nature, Satchit Ananda, and the lower nature, is the supramental consciousness, that which takes the unity and throws it into diversity. That allows the transmission of Satchit-Ananda into the lower world, and must be the bridge as evolution commences and reaches its culmination, that which permits Satchit-Ananda to manifest fully. So, the work is at a midpoint. It is reaching a critical point where the supramental must manifest because the cosmos demands it, and because that in us which is real and conscious demand it also. The last and supreme emergence. It lies in front of us. Now we are still struggling with the divisiveness natural to mind. I think we'll put a bookmark there and then we'll continue. I think we will be working in this chapter into January. It'll take about 7 sessions to complete our work in chapter 24. Tonight, a section from Savitri. This is in Book 3, the Book of the Divine Mother, in Canto 3, the House of the Spirit and the New Creation. Against this glory of spiritual states, their parallels and yet their opposites, floated and swayed, eclipsed and shadow-like, as if a doubt-made substance, flickering, pale, this other scheme two vast negations found. A world that knows not its inhabiting self, labors to find its cause and need to be. A spirit ignorant of the world it made, obscured by matter, travestied by life, struggles to emerge, to be free, to know and reign. These were close tied in one disharmony. Yet the divergent lines met not at all. Three powers governed its irrational course. In the beginning, an unknowing force. In the middle, an embodied striving soul. In its end, a silent spirit denying life. A dull and infelicitous interlude unrolls its dubious truth to a questioning mind, compelled by the ignorant power to play its part and to record her inconclusive tale, the mystery of her inconscient plan, and the riddle of a being born from night by a marriage of necessity with chance. This darkness hides our nobler destiny. A chrysalis of a great and glorious truth, it stifles the winged marvel in its sheath, lest from the prison of matter it escape, and wasting its beauty on the formless vast, merged into the unknowable's mystery, leave unfulfilled the world's miraculous fate. As yet thought only some high spirit's dream, or a vexed illusion in man's toiling mind, a new creation from the old shall rise, a knowledge inarticulate find speech, beauty suppressed burst into paradise bloom, pleasure and pain dive into absolute bliss. a tongueless oracle shall speak at last. The superconscient conscious grow on earth. The eternal's wonders join the dance of time. But now all seemed a vainly teeming vast, upheld by a deluded energy to a spectator self-absorbed and mute, careless of the unmeaning show he watched, regarding the bizarre procession pass, like one who waits for an expected end. He saw a world that is from a world to be. So, namaste, jai ma.